This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nobel and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Toni Morrison is about to be honored again. At the National Book Awards ceremonies next Wednesday, Morrison will be given a special medal for distinguished contribution to American letters. Meanwhile, Oprah recently announced that Morrison's 1977 novel, Song of Solomon, is the selection for the November edition of Oprah's Book Club. That has sent the book to the top of the bestseller list. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Morrison in 1992 after the publication of her novel, Jazz. Jazz is set in Harlem in 1926 and is about African Americans who move from the rural South to the urban North. It's also about love, jealousy, violence, and aging. A woman named Violet finds out her husband has been having an affair with a younger woman who he has killed. At the funeral, Violet takes revenge on the corpse. Here's Toni Morrison reading from the opening.
I know that woman. She used to live with a flock of birds on Lenox Avenue. Know her husband, too. He fell for an 18-year-old girl with one of those deep-down, spooky loves that made him so sad and happy he shot her just to keep the feeling going. When the woman, her name is Violet, went to the funeral to see the girl and to cut her dead face, they threw her to the floor and out of the church. She ran then through all that snow, and when she got back to her apartment, she took the birds from their cages and set them out the windows to freeze or fly, including the parrot that said, "I love you." The snow she ran through was so windswept, she left no footprints in it, so for a time, nobody knew exactly where on Lenox Avenue she lived. But like me, they knew who she was, who she had to be, because they knew that her husband, Joe Trace, was the one who shot the girl. There was never anyone to prosecute him because nobody actually saw him do it. And the dead girl's aunt didn't want to throw money to helpless lawyers or laughing cops when she knew the expense wouldn't improve anything. Besides, she found out that the man who killed her niece cried all day. And for him and for Violet, that is as bad as jail.
No, the woman who cuts the face of the dead woman, a character later says to the woman who does the cutting, "I don't understand women like you, women with knives." Do you understand women with knives, kind of crimes of passion like that?
Not entirely. I think part of the reason I was interested in the story and in that period was some way to figure out the impulses for violence as a sort of notion of solution and how it plays into notions of license and freedom. So it was a quest, really, on my part. I'm not quite sure I understand that kind of excess.
Was there a particular crime that you wanted to understand, or a particular woman with a knife who you wanted to understand?
The woman I really wanted to understand was Dorcas, the young girl who is based on a historical figure, actually, a young girl who died in Harlem at a rent party, shot by her lover with a silencer, and who refused to let anybody help her because she wanted to give him time to get away, and waited so long that she bled to death. That was extremely provocative to me, that notion of that kind of romance that probably is representative of someone that young. Her acceptance of his violence, the way in which a young girl or a woman deals with assault under certain circumstances in certain eras and periods.
What's the closest you've seen to this in real life?
I've never seen any of it. I mean, I don't... If I had seen it, or participated in it, I probably wouldn't be so interested in writing about it. But it was sort of outside one's own personal experience that is compulsive.
No family legends or neighborhood legends from when you were growing up?
Not about women. About men, yes, who were championed because of their endurance and their response to violence associated with them. But the women that I knew were, I suppose, in a manner verbally able to deflect violence. There's a passage in Jazz about the kind of women who needed a certain kind of protection. There were those who had razors taped to their hands. There were those who were willing to boil a lie, and those who were willing to put ground glass in food. But there is a secondary passage which explains what a large majority of black women did in terms of trying to protect themselves. The church, the club movement, the acquisition of property. I think the line goes, any black woman in 1926 who did not share some of those protective gestures was silent or crazy or dead.
Hmm. Toni Morrison is my guest. You have this sense in your novel, Jazz, of people coming to Harlem or coming to the city and feeling more like themselves there, more like the people they always believed they were, is the way you put it. That's obviously something you were really interested in developing in the story, just what it meant physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
For people move to the city. You must have stories about that in your family history.
Oh, I do, yes. That move from the rural areas where I think in literature sometimes we romanticize into the freedom of the countryside, you know, the sort of ability to commune with nature and be one's transcendent self. And there is that mythos in literature. And there is an accompanying one, which is the freedom of a city. On the one hand, there's a certain kind of anonymity. But more particularly, especially for African Americans, it was moving into an area where there were so many of you. You could see yourself in your number. And there was a certain kind of protection in that, as well as some license. Also, it was, I don't know, the idea of a city as being a place where there is a mix, where there are many classes, many kinds of people. And however eccentric you are, there are, you know, at least 100 other people who are eccentric in precisely the same way. So that one has solitude, solitariness, individuality, and community in a city. I'm not sure we can think up a city like that anymore. But that's what the ideal is. And that's why, you know, when we think of New York in the 20s or other large urban areas in our either invented mechanisms or actually historically there, what was the innocence and the sin, the excitement and the comfort of being in a huge metropolitan area? And I think that, you know, impelled and compelled African-Americans as it did immigrants. There was a risk there, but there was enormous opportunity, and there was some safety.
Would you share with us one of your parents' migration stories?
Yes. I think one of the ones that I remember best was when my mother's parents left the South, left Alabama. My grandmother's husband, my grandfather, had gone to a large city to earn some money playing the violin, as a matter of fact, and she was alone on their farm with these children who were very, very young. I think my mother was 5. And there was some danger about it. It was the time when a woman alone with several children was a kind of a target, and her words were that when she noticed white boys beginning to circle that house, she had to leave immediately. So she sent word to her husband, to my grandfather, by somebody who was en route to tell him that she would be on X train at X time, and that if he wanted to see them again, he should be there. And so they left in the middle of the night and went to Birmingham and got on the train. And as the train pulled out, there was no papa. And the children all began to wail and cry. And a few miles outside the city, he appeared. But he hadn't felt that he could show himself at the station and get on with them because they were escaping that cycle of debt, you know, that round that you can never really escape because, you know, the commissary of the general store you need for the feed and that takes the crops, etc. So it was a happy event for them. And then the subsequent stops on that route to where they were headed looking for work for mines that were asking for laborers, for mills, for women who could work in service, is an interesting and very typical story. And they ended up on the shores of Lake Erie, where I was born.
In Ohio?
Yes.
What was Lorraine like when you were growing up? What kind of neighborhood were you growing up in?
It was an interesting place. I still think it's remarkable. In that part of Ohio, and I think in a large, in many of those states, I never lived in a black neighborhood because what we were living in were really just poor neighborhoods. So that I grew up with all of the other immigrants who were coming to this country because it was a steel town. And everybody, whether they were Polish people or what they used to call Slovenes in those days, had their own halls, churches, and, family life. That was not mixed. You know, you didn't exchange on those areas in those days. But there's one high school, four junior high schools, and we all went to the same school.
So what was the African-American cultural center? Was it the church or was it something else? The church?
Absolutely, the church.
And you'd go every Sunday? Beyond Sunday?
Well, they had a very, complicated social life. Mm-hmm. Part of it was Sunday, part of it was Sunday school, but a lot of it was taking care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I remember most is the impetus and the necessity for my mother and her friends and for all of us to take food to people who needed it or to go clean somebody's house if they were bedridden. All sorts of chores were taken for granted. When people got old, they didn't have any place for them to go. And if their families were indigent or couldn't take care of them, that was the responsibility of the women of the church or of the neighborhood. It was just a constant part of one's life. I think in The Bluest Eye, I recorded something similar that really happened, which is my sister and I would sleep in the same bed, and we might wake up, and there might be a child next to us, somebody who was in difficulty, or the parent was sick or gone, and women in the neighborhood would take them in. And there might be some children living with us for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or months or what have you. And we were not, it was a kind of violation of what everybody seems to think is important now, which is intimacy and privacy. And of course, as a young girl, I wanted to leave it. But at the same time, it was a kind of sharing of of responsibilities, social responsibilities. No one ever talked about it and said, you ought to be a responsible member of the society. But everything people did was like that.
Well, it would seem to me that in your adult life as a single mother, writer, and editor, that you would have had precious little time to devote to the community. I mean, because you had to be so busy with bringing up your own children and earning a living and writing and so on.
It's true. I had precious little time. I didn't think of it that way because I understood my work to be very much bound up with service to mm-hmm. the community. But what I missed, I'll have to tell you, was a community service to me. I understood that if I lived in Lorain, Ohio, and I was working and I had small children, I wouldn't have to get a babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would do that and ask me, did I need help? Or, those kinds of things on the block or on the street were people who watched your children because they took that as part of what being an adult was like.
My guest is Toni Morrison. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Toni Morrison is my guest. In your new book of literary criticism, Playing in the Dark, you write about how until recently American readers were assumed to be white, and you wonder what that assumption has meant to the literary imagination in America. When you started reading, were you conscious of reading books in which there were few, if any, black characters?
No, I was conscious of there being a sort of disruption in some books when black people did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a kind of embarrassment, a kind of a need to skip over those parts in, say, being in the 10th grade and reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, or seeing children's books in which, was it Sambo? I mean, you know, these kinds of things. And you sort of politely erase them from your consciousness until you get older. And then when I became a writer, I had to function in a language that was coded in a number of ways. And I had to work with those codes. I didn't have access to some of the metaphors and shortcuts that, say, a white writer has who feels he or she is unraced, and they can take for granted the centrality of their experience because it is white, and they think that's being without a race. Everybody else has race. White people don't. They could take for granted that kind of centrality, and they could use cleverly, brilliantly, effectively or not, as the case might be, the presence of black people, just as they frequently did the presence of women. It's sort of something you have in your kit.
So when you say that the language was coded, let me get you to elaborate on the kind of code you felt you had to cut through or work around.
Well, calling slaves slaves instead of laborers or workers is one code. Using black women and men to appear in a scene for no reason other than to provide the tension that might suggest illegal sexuality or violence. They have no other function except to define and to suggest to be the association of. And you wonder, why are they there? And they may never be picked up again. But they have this impact. To have classical American literature to need to establish virtue, power, and dominance over something, and to need an obedient black person or someone who loves you irrationally. Mark Twain's Jim is irrational in that sense. His love is boundless, and he's a grown man talking to children. I could not do that, say, with a white man who was an ex-convict.
I think it's fair to say that in most of your fiction, there's really been very few significant white characters.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so how does that relate to what you're talking about now, about the, you know, about the code and...
In a sense, having, it would be silly for me to write or to concentrate on major white characters because I wasn't interested in it, and also it destabilizes the progress of the narrative in a way. For example, putting a young black girl center stage seemed to me a radical thing to do in 1965 when I first began writing The Bluest Eye. Once you begin to permit the reins of the narrative to be held by a major white person, you lose the agency and you lose the terrain, the imaginative terrain, because you may be forced into responding to a white presence instead of examining what the interior lives of these people are without the constant need to explain, to editorialize, and to fix. So it was an enormous liberation for me, and one that I find to be repeated a lot, particularly in the work of black women. Once you take those people out, then it's as though the whole world is available now for one's own creativity. But in a sense, it's all a little bit more real than that. White people were not central to my life. They were out there, sort of on the edge, sometimes wonderful and enabling, sometimes hostile and disabling. But the heart of the life, even in the town that I described, was in our household, in our family, so that in the novels I wanted to, in that sense, not have characters who were always required to do what I don't think we were required to do is to consistently think about what white people were thinking. It makes you reduce them in some sort of stereotypical way that I would shy away from. But certainly I was interested and fascinated by and sort of thrilled by a number of minor figures, that is, secondary figures, enabling figures in who are white, such as Amy Denver in Beloved, who is not required to be a white person in that scene because she's not around any other white people. So she can go ahead and be a person. And also, she does something I think that almost never happens, if ever, in American fiction, which is to have a white person touch a black person with some motive other than sex or violence.
Toni Morrison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Toni Morrison will receive a special medal for distinguished contribution to American letters next Wednesday at the National Book Awards ceremony. Our interview was recorded in 1992. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.